To get the tape started, I just want to acknowledge the very untimely death of Tony Laurie's father last night. I'm sure any of you that knew his mother while she served or are familiar with Jean Laurie will want to extend your sympathies to their family. Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We're going to do a little bit of overview on a number of agencies that have been having difficulty lately. We're going to begin with the Minneapolis Veterans Home, and most of us were pretty upset to learn that the Department of Justice is investigating the agency, and having read about it in the paper, we thought we should get a little more detail here today. I don't know if everyone wants to come up to the table at once. Who's testifying on this?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gil Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare. And with me I have Ms. Jill Smith, Assistant Administrator for the Minneapolis Veterans Home.
And is Pam Barrow going to be with us today?
Pam Barrow is in the audience, ma'am.
Okay.
We also have our newly appointed Administrator for the Veterans Home. I wanted to introduce her to the committee as well.
Well, whenever you want to do that, just let me know.
Thank you, ma'am. First of all, thank you very much for allowing us to come and give you an update and a briefing. The intent today is just to give you an overview of where we've been over the summer with some of the corrections that we've made, and then go into the CRIPA, which is the Civil Rights for Institutionalized Persons Act, which is the part of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division that is conducting the investigation here in the not-too-distant future. First off, I'd like to point out that Commissioner Dyrud is in the audience. And I'd like to point out Ms. Pam Barrows, who is the Senior Director for Veterans Healthcare, sitting in the back, has been the interim administrator at the home since July. And then I'd like to introduce Ms. Judy Kirky Coleman. We're very happy to have her as our newly appointed administrator for the Veterans Home down in Minneapolis. In the slide presentation that I have in front of you, just a really quick overview of the five veterans homes that we have, Laverne, Fergus Falls, Silver Bay, Minneapolis, and Hastings. We also have our central office for the veterans homes. We moved our office to the Minneapolis campus, Building 10. That took place last week, and that's where the operations for the overseeing the veterans homes will be operating out of, is Building 10 over at the Minneapolis campus. So. Leadership for the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, Commissioner Clark Dyrud. Then you have two deputy commissioners, Deputy Commissioner Michael Puglisi and myself, Pam Burrows and Reggie Worlds as senior directors for the department.
So will there be an office also in St. Paul?
I will have an office, ma'am, at St. Paul, and then have an office at the Minneapolis campus as well.
And will there be other staff at the Minneapolis office?
We have at the Minneapolis, Madam Chair, at the Minneapolis campus, we have all of the staff that we had at the St. Paul office that was for the Veterans Home, that used to be part of the Veterans Home Board. We have the executive assistant. We have Ms. Pam Burrows, that will be at the Minneapolis campus, our quality assurance director. We will also have our legal analyst at the Minneapolis campus.
And how many staff will you have in the St. Paul office?
It'll be the central office for the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, which have been programs and services in the past, which will be the legislative, public affairs, budgeting, those types of staff along
that's
with myself.
For the department itself, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Will there be any other staff besides yourself for the veterans homes?
No.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. The patient characteristics for skilled nursing, average age is about 78, predominantly male, World War II veterans. The top diagnoses or disease are Alzheimer's disease, dementia with behavioral disturbance, organic brain syndrome, and have had multiple nursing home stays prior to coming to the veterans home. We also have board and care predominantly at the Hastings home, but we do have board and care at the Minneapolis campus. Average age is 58. Predominantly male, Vietnam veteran, top three diagnoses or disease of alcohol dependency syndrome, schizophrenic disorder, and affective psychosis, depression, and often they are homeless prior to coming to the Hastings or the Minneapolis home, but not in all cases. The Minneapolis Veterans Home, as I pointed out, we have a new administrator, Judy Kirky Coleman. It's the administrator, was established in 1887, 291-bed skilled nursing facility and 50 beds domiciliary. Next slide just talks about a waiting list. We currently have approximately 22 for domiciliary and 265 for our skilled nursing at the Minneapolis campus. The other homes will show that Silver Bay has 6, Laverne 66, and Fergus Falls 62. Hastings currently does not have a waiting list for domiciliary care. The Minneapolis Veterans Home prior to November, this is just an overview. I'm not saying anything that you don't already know, but I just wanted to kind of highlight there were some regulatory issues, long-term care and systems breakdown, leadership concerns, staffing concerns, lack of trust and confidence in the staff's ability, and lack of confidence from the legislators. On November 19th, when the leadership or the governance of the Minnesota Veterans Homes were put under the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the following has taken place. To present, we've cleared all of our survey issues with the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. We are currently in the survey window, so we're anticipating a visit from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs at any time. We've cleared the Department of Health surveys issues with a one-day fine that was assessed at $700 plus the survey costs. And we're working on best practices and quality improvement. All five homes have just recently received a best-in-class that was prepared by Pinnacle, which is a customer service company that will go out and do customer service surveys of family members and residents. And the areas were nursing care, laundry, food service, those types of things. Some of the things that we're working on also is we're rebuilding a systems approach to long-term care. We're using the lean process, Kaizen events, strategic planning, and we're also training the staff. Rebuilding a strong leadership team through accountability and respect, and we're also developing a new nursing staff model. Staff training and development to reestablish the veterans' home's reputation. We're going out and seeking assistance from various organizations such as the Minnesota Aging and as well as care providers to provide the same type of training that you would get at any other nursing home in the industry. Providing quarterly updates and reports to legislative chairs and inform and educate legislators on veterans' homes issues when asked. I'd like to turn over the next portion of this to Ms. Jill Smith. She was the director of nursing, hired in January, and has since been promoted to the assistant administrator for clinical care that can talk more about these issues.
Madam Chair and committee members, it's my pleasure to talk about some of the project improvements that we've made since the first of the year. We've done a lot of systems reviews looking at medication management, vulnerable adult reporting and mandated reporting, wound care, chemical and physical restraint reduction, looking at information technology enhancements for our electronic medical record, bowel and bladder programs, looking at our quality improvement system. We've implemented some social work case management via the admissions process. So as you noted, there were 265 residents on the waiting list. The social work case management is helping them to find resources prior to coming in while they wait to come to our campus. Behavioral services programming. We've looked at our comprehensive resident assessment process to look at an interdisciplinary approach and bringing all of that information together to create a viable plan of care for each individual resident. We're reviewing our infection control program, trying to link it more solidly to organisms and then employee health kinds of things. Enhancing our rehab program as well. Some of the other project improvements, leadership development. We have held an extensive nursing leadership seminar, and that was put on via consultant through the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. And interdepartmental leadership training is also occurring. Human resource development, taking a look at what are our recruitment strategies and what are our retention strategies, and implementing a new nursing staff model. Positions we've been able to fill on each unit in the facility include the nurse manager, a registered nurse senior, RNs and LPNs, and HSTs. Vacancies as of October 1st, you can see that we still have LPNs 20.9 FTEs to fill and HSTs at 15.9 FTEs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're also in the process of an informal solicitation for a statewide study on future veterans' homes. We want to make sure that it's carefully looked at so that we, if there is a discussion about future veterans' homes in the state of Minnesota, we're looking at demographics, access to care, the demographics of actually the number of veterans in that particular area. We're also conducting an informal solicitation for a future the future of the Minneapolis campus and the seven-county metro area. And in that study is to look at the campus itself to see whether it is feasible to continue to operate the Minneapolis campus as is or look at other opportunities such as potentially other care centers within the seven-county metro area. This came out of last year's omnibus bill. Building 9... As you know, ma'am, the Building 9 was identified as condemned last year around October, and we're in the process right now of working with the Historical Society to identify a time so we can demolish the building and then build the new Building 9. The new Building 9 will be a resident-centered approach. Some of the things such as culture change that we're looking at in Building 9, but not just Building 9, all of our care centers, all of our veterans' homes, our resident-centered focus on care, Eden philosophy, community, neighborhood-type approach. We're looking at family-style meals, and as the committee will probably know, the downtown approach that Fergus Falls has that works very well with the family members and the residents. We've taken on a lean approach to health care and veteran health care. Lean is about focus, removing waste, and increasing customer value. On June 9th, we held our first Kaizen event. Kaizen is change good in Japanese, and what we've done is we've taken the medication distribution process and ran a Kaizen event. That Kaizen event, and I'll have Ms. Smith talk about that here briefly, but was very successful for the Minneapolis campus. On July 31st, we've also done conducted a second Kaizen event. This one was on the programs and services side on claims process. And we find that that has also been very successful for the department. The steps in the Kaizen and the Lean process for the Kaizen events is basically identifying the activities that create value, determine the sequence of activities, eliminate activities that do not add value, allow the customer to pull products and services, and then to improve the process and start over. In the handout, there is a slide there that talks about the swim lane mapping. and that was a result of the Minneapolis Medication Management Lean Kaizen event. If I could have Ms. Jill Smith talk about this briefly.
Madam Chair and committee members, the Lean event that we did looked at, as Gil said, the medication distribution process. So one of the first things that we did is identify what's the goals of the process, or the project, excuse me, and looked at the five R's: the right medication, right dose, right time, right route, right resident, right documentation, as part of our goal 100% of the time, because we felt in that room that none of us wanted to be that 1% that maybe wasn't quite right. So we're looking at 100%. Then we looked at observations of our current process. Swim lane mapping identifies the process of the physician writing an order all the way to the distribution to the resident and the documentation that needs to occur. So the swim lane map was allowed us to look at each of those steps in the process, looking for any wait times, any duplication of services, those kinds of things that we could cut out. Once we looked at our current process, then we identified ways that we could improve the process, looked for improvement opportunities. Once we identified those, and we had identified many that we couldn't take on right at that very second, but put it in a parking lot to address later, identified what actions we would want to take. And when we did that, then we were able to really tune in and create a new physician order sheet to eliminate duplication, pre-printed labeling, created standards of work throughout the facility, looking at military time orders, transcription, medication refills and deliveries, standardize our new medication carts so that each unit's cart is set up the same way, and standardize our forms file cabinets. Once we created those work standards, then we looked at developing a 30-day action plan and identify the lessons that we learned. And I think the lessons that we most learned was bringing the right stakeholders together to a committee to take action is essential. And in this committee, we had representatives from pharmacy, nursing, licensed nurses, the health information person, and then also a pharmacy tech. So we were able to really identify where the duplication was and how could we fixed it, and then also looked at how we're going to sustain the changes that we put in place.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we as part of the Long-Term Care Commission, Long-Term Care Advisory Council was identified and put in place as of November 19, 2007. We looked at the recommendations from the from the Long-Term Care Commission, and the recommendations were professional care planning coordination, alternative to institutional care, new housing with service options, and excellence in chronic disease management, nursing, and rehabilitative care. The Advisory Council held their first meeting on June 24, 2008. In that meeting, we had introductions and expectations that were given to the Advisory Council, update on the veterans' homes and the strategic plan, identifying future meetings. The second meeting was held on September 23rd. During that meeting, we talked about the Long-Term Care Commission's recommendations and started working on those recommendations. We identified future meetings at that time, and the next meeting is scheduled for January 20th at the Veterans Service Building here in St. Paul. Members of the advisory councils are on your slide there. It has Catherine Roberts as our chair and other members of the committee as well. Update on the Department of Justice Civil Rights Institutionalized Persons Act, CRIPA. In July 2008, a letter was written to the governor notifying the state that the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division will be conducting an investigation of the Minneapolis Veterans Home pursuant to their authority under the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act. The investigation will focus on health care services, including medical and nursing care services, whether residents are safe from abuse and other harm, and whether residents are served in the most integrated setting appropriate to their needs. Department of Justice has not reached a conclusion about the subject matter of the investigation. However, the Department of Justice in the letter did state that they feel that the state and the home wants to operate the home within constitutional and federal laws. During the course of the Department of Justice investigation, they will consider all relevant information, particularly the efforts the state has taken to ensure compliance with federal law. They will also offer to provide recommendations on ways to improve the conditions of the facility when appropriate. Department of Justice states that provided that the state cooperates fully with the investigation, if they conclude that they are not systematic violations of the constitutional rights of other federal rights, they will notify the governor that they will be closing the investigation. However, if they feel that there are such violations at the facility, they will be writing findings and identify the minimum measures that they feel need to be done to remedy the violations. And that will also include identifying any financial, technical, or other assistance the United States can provide to assist us in that process. Department of Justice has requested copies of several documents to be sent to them prior to their visit. However, due to the Minnesota Governmental Data Practices Act, we're not able to send them the personal identifiable information they requested. However, we did send redacted information just to show that we are willing to cooperate. We've also explained to them the process that they can work through. We are assisting in that process so that they can receive the information they requested. We've also contacted the family members and let the family members know that if they feel that they wanted to release, sign a release so they can release the information directly to the Department of Justice, they can do so and we can assist them in that process. The visit, CRIPA visit, was scheduled for September 28th, 29th, but has been postponed until the Department of Justice has reviewed our position under the Minnesota Governmental Data Practices Act. We are currently working with the Attorney General's Office and the Governor's Office with regards to the CRIPA investigation. We have given updates and briefings, whether by phone or through letter, to the Governor's Office, legislative chairs, advisory council, staff, residents, and family members, and the veterans community. We're cooperating with the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, to the full extent of the law. Last year, during the legislative process, there were several questions about our strategic plan. We are embarked on a strategic planning. We started right away. We took a look at the merger of the Veterans Homes and the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs as one department. And so we started with our mission. We took a look at our mission, and our mission at the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs is dedicated to serving Minnesota veterans and their families. We took a look at our vision statement, where do we want to go? And the vision statement is meeting the needs of Minnesota veterans and their families by providing proven and innovative programs and services to maximize quality of life. We wanted to make sure that our core values were consistent throughout the agency. And as you see in the slide, it has the core values, which is veterans first in our hearts, minds, and actions, excellence in our standards, trust through results. Ethics is our cornerstone. Respect for service, past and present, advocacy for care and services, nation leading in services, and stewardship of resources. We've identified some goals and objectives and strategies for each one of our objectives. I won't go through each objective and strategy, but I can have those available. Our first goal is an integrated service goal. As a merging department, we felt we needed to identify all of our merging needs as a department, so we integrated services is our first goal. Our second goal identifies financial integrity, and that is to look at not just being good steward of state resources, but also looking at ways to to find ways and resources to supplement independent of state appropriated funds. Our third goal is organizational systems. We want to make sure that our systems as a department are consistent with the industry. And so we identified an organizational support goal. Our fourth goal is to strategies to foster employee morale and strong partnership with stakeholders. We have gone through the first stage and presented our goals and objectives to stakeholders, had a meeting, received some feedback. We're getting ready to meet as a department again to go through and finish up our strategic plan and taking the recommendations from our stakeholders very seriously. And then our fifth goal is Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. We'll meet the needs of the veterans community by providing innovative customer service. We want to make sure that our customers are cared for and we are listening to our customers. Leadership, we're in the process of hiring a assistant administrator. We were very fortunate to have Ms. Jill Smith as our director of nursing. And just to show some efficiencies in our process, we've promoted Ms. Jill Smith to the assistant administrator, and she is acting as an assistant administrator for clinical services, which also provides director of nursing type services. So she is doing assistant administrator duties as well as the director of nursing services duties as well. Quality director and a plant manager. The future of the Minnesota Veterans Home System, what we're looking at is a one-stop shopping for veterans, assisted living, warrior services, which is a variety of services to those that have served, adult day health care, future homes, and respite, hospice, or home care. We can't do what we do without a support of our stakeholders, and I want to mention that our veteran service organizations have been a tremendous support and have been there with us from the beginning, and I just wanted to mention that we can do what we do without their assistance and support. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I stand ready to answer your questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. You indicate that you're anticipating a visit from SDVA, and I'm wondering when that happens, how is it that you are intending to communicate that visit with this committee?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, what I've done is when things happen that I feel is important for the committee to know, or I should say the chairs of the committees to know, I contact our legislative director and make sure that we notify the chairs immediately. Then the second thing that I started is an update letter. It's a packet that I put together with significant information. It ranges from some of our pinnacle or some of our quality indicators, and it just talks about things that are happening. But as soon as things occur, we notify the chairs immediately.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, thank you. Deputy Commissioner, I should take an opportunity to at least acknowledge that you've brought forth at least part of your strategic plan with you today. I have been quite critical of the organization and its lack thereof. So I'm pleased to see that you're moving along in that direction. It looks rather ambitious with at least five goals, and so I wish you the best in trying to put together how you're going to, as important as identifying what the goals are, how it is that you are intending to address each of those successfully. My last question is with regard to your vacancies. And each time that you have appeared before us, we have been told that you are in the midst, you are in the process of hiring new leadership and new administrators. And today is no different. You're in the process of hiring new leadership. And today is also no different in that there are a number of vacancies that you continue to have on your staffing needs. And I'm wondering if you'd like to, again, talk to us about what you're doing to try to resolve those vacancies. I would think that Failure to do so is going to make it quite difficult to accomplish the goals that you've set forth.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, thank you for the questions. First, I would be more than happy to provide you a copy of our goals, objectives, and strategies on how we're going to attempt to meet our strategic plan and receive any feedback or comments that you may have to assist us in that process. As far as the coming back and talking about vacancies and making attempts, my statement from the time I came into Minnesota was that I was going to hire an administrator first and that I was going to look very hard to find the right person. It has taken me 10 months to find that person. So we have the new administrator on board. We have gone through, we have people right now in the quality manager that we're just waiting after today to make an offer and hire that position. We had a person in the position, didn't quite work out, and the person left. So we are in the process of doing that. I know you've heard that before, but I'm here to tell you that the next time I come up here, I may be saying the same thing because it's hard to say when it comes to personnel issues. But as far as I am concerned, we wanted to make sure we got the right person as the administrator. We've done that. I feel confident in that, and we are in the process of hiring the remaining staff. We did hire the assistant administrator, so that's the second hire that we have from prior that was said. As far as our nursing vacancies, do you want to talk about that, Jill? Or?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, nursing recruiting, some of the things that we've done to address that situation is created a master schedule complete with position control numbers. We now know exactly what we need to fill for each position to implement the nursing care model that we want to move forward. We have timely vacancy postings, and although it seems like we always will have openings, and we probably will because the turnover rates in the nursing industry are pretty sizable, we have been able to recruit 71 HSTs, 15 LPNs. We've recruited two pharmacists, a physical therapist, and that position was open well over a year. We've been able to recruit an occupational therapist. That was a position open well over a year. We just now brought on two recreation therapists, again, positions that have been open well over a year, and are in the process of hopefully bringing two chaplains on board, of which we're very excited about. Our retention efforts include continuous staff education. I should have brought the binder of all the staff education that we've done to try to retain quality staff and give staff the tools they need to do a great job. We've identified poor performers, and we are dealing with that situation using either performance improvement process or the disciplinary process. We are tracking attendance. We standardize our shift start and stop times. Career development, we revised that particular program to assist members of our staff with continuing education. We are a student training site for some of our departments, and we're having town hall meetings. I'm meeting just on a monthly basis with the HSTs or nursing assistants and the licensed nurse just to sit down. Where are we at? What do we need to do? How are we going to make this work? So those are some of our strategies as we speak.
I guess it would only be fair to point out that we've been having new people filling all of these positions for over 5 years now. I would say almost every time the Minneapolis Veterans Home has appeared in front of this committee, there have been different people. And so one doesn't always believe that different people are going to make different things happen, because we have been trying to see different things happen for over 5 years now. And we just hope that you understand that. So Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I have a series of questions. May I just continue them?
Sure.
Thank you. Can I assume that when you're describing the systems reviews in your presentation, medication management, vulnerable adult reporting, et cetera, wound care, and then also under the human resource development, the recruitment and retention strategies that would address what Senator Berglund and Senator Lynch were just talking about, that you have some measurable outcomes that will be able to demonstrate when you report back to us what the baseline was that was the problem and then what the outcomes are. Because I find it difficult to listen to this without understanding what is the problem that's trying to be addressed. I understand you're doing systems review to find ways to accomplish that, but what are your benchmarks or what dots are you moving and how can we have access to that information? Because that's really the critical question for me. Just the one measure of retention would be important, but there's a variety of them that contributed to a comprehensive problem in the system. And I would very much hope that you have benchmarks lined up that will be able to give us a sense of whether or not these interventions or these strategies are, in effect, changing the culture and changing the outcomes in the system. Is that part of your plan?
Is it? That, Madam Chair, Senator, yes, it is part of our plan. One of the things that I'm working on is developing a best practices committee. And in the best practices committee is to identify not only things that we're doing well at each home, but also areas that can be improved. With that, we're going to tie measures to it. We have a program called EQIP. EQIP is our quality indicators. And from a care perspective, we're able to identify benchmarks and comparison to other facilities within the state and the nation and other veterans' homes. When it comes to the HR and the retention, we're starting to track those as well. We're benchmarking, but we have to start somewhere. And so as we're going through repairing and changing some of the systems that we have, we're identifying our benchmarks, and we're, at that point, tracking it forward. And I hope that answered your question, ma'am.
Thank you. Your answer, I think, is that that's your plan to do that.
Yes, we are planning.
And that I'm hoping that there's some urgency to that. That in the amount, I mean, we've been meeting and talking about this over some period of time, and I would think there would be something instituted that would give us some feedback already as to whether or not these benchmarks are changing.
Madam Chair, Senator, we do have some benchmarks right now that we can provide you, and Jill Smith can talk a little bit about that right now, as a matter of fact.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the EQIP data that we have benchmarks us nationally with a group of nursing facilities as well as benchmarks against other veterans' homes. And so we're able to use that data to determine what kinds of quality improvement projects we want to take forward. So for instance, one of the things I mentioned, pressure ulcers, as one of our systems review. Because of the systems review, the daily documentation, weekly care rounds, and the standardizing of our treatment products, we are below the national level for the number of pressure ulcers in a facility. Mm.
That is the idea, although I'm hoping that your standard will be against your own. I mean, if your benchmark would be a reduction of the acquired pneumonias, the number of wounds, the time it takes to reduce the wound, that it's against yourself,
sure,
and that it's a constant self-improvement rather than simply accepting standards that are national or broader. Okay, the second question that I'd like to ask is, I noticed the waiting list report that there one of the veteran homes doesn't have any, and I was just curious to know as to what the explanation would be for that.
Madam Chair, Senator, the one home that does not have a waiting list is the Hastings home, and they're very specific to domiciliary care, boarding care. And that is, we are out working with the VA hospitals, trying to see if there are residents that are out there or veterans that are out there that need that particular type of care. It's not nursing care. It's not 24-hour skilled nursing. We do a very unique type of care there in that we provide mental health and rehab services, things such as vocational rehabilitation, trying to get a veteran back on their feet and back out into the community so they can be part of the community again. So we do have 22, if you look at the waiting list at Minneapolis for board and care, and we've contacted those individuals and had made the offer to go to Hastings because there are vacancies available, but they have turned us down. They are not interested.
I'm just curious to know what there's 22 waiting in Minneapolis and 62 in Fergus Falls and none in Hastings for either supportive or domiciliary housing. I just wonder if there is some system problem that needs to be examined there as well.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's a different type of care. It's a different level of care. So we couldn't send the people that were on the waiting list for Fergus Falls to Hastings because that would exceed the ability for us to care for them at that facility.
Well, and that may lead to, it may even answer my next question, because I noticed that you also said that you had hired, or you were in your new approach, using social service case management to address the 265 persons who are on the waiting list, that there's some initial contact from the system to the waiting list group that can't get in to do some sort of provision of interim services in order to give some assistance to them prior to being able to place, which it's just sort of a rhetorical question. I would wonder if we're really examining, as we have in other healthcare systems, the possibility of finding more community-based or less intensive services. I know that for very severely disabled population, we have been able to find smaller systems to be able to support people to live more community-based rather than in these facilities. And so when you start to say that Hastings is a different level of care, what are we doing to really examine whether or not we're providing an opportunity for our veterans to have community-based living that keeps them engaged and involved in a higher quality of life?
Senator... Madam Chair, Senator, those are the discussions that we're going to be talking about to conclude our strategic planning, and those are the things that we're already discussing those things. And I know that the case management is a part of that discussion as well.
When was your last mock survey done at the Minneapolis home?
Mock survey.
No, I don't have the date.
Madam Chair, I don't have that date in front of me. We can get that back to you.
What were the results of that mock survey?
Mock survey? I don't...
We funded mock surveys to be at least...
Pathways report?
At least two per year to be done at the Minneapolis home.
That's the pathway report.
Huh. We're discussing a couple things here, Madam Chair. We have monitors in place. That's not what you're...
No.
In the mock surveys that you're...
This is when an outside organization comes into the home and conducts a survey as if they were the Minnesota Department of Health. And then they give you the results afterwards so that you can be in a position to be continuously improving during times when you're not... actually being fined.
I would have to get back to you, Madam Chair. I would have to get back to you on that.
Do you at this time have an individual care plan for each resident at the Minneapolis home?
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am.
And does that individual care plan have attached to it the appropriate number of nursing hours to be provided to that resident?
Madam Chair, our staffing model is designed to provide productive hours of nursing based on our comprehensive assessment process with guidelines that are established through the Medicare RUGS system, so yes.
And with the vacancy level that you run regularly, are you able to meet that number of nursing hours for the patients based on their individualized care plan?
Madam Chair, yes. We will use overtime as needed on a voluntary basis, and then we use contract agency staff as needed as well.
And how much overtime and contract staff are you using at the Minneapolis home right now?
For contract staff, for licensed practical nurses for the month of September, we had 579 contract hours. For RN staff, we had 36 hours. And for the HST or nursing assistants, I'm very pleased to say we had zero contract agency hours. Overtime hours for registered nurse overtime hours, these are voluntary, 337. For licensed practical nurses, 837. And for the nursing assistants, 2,993.
And when you pay overtime or pay for contract services, are you paying more than you would if you were filling that position and paying on an hourly basis?
Madam Chair, yes. For overtime, it's time and a half. And for contract agencies, it's above our normal rate of pay.
And so how much to date has a Minneapolis home paid over and above what they would be paying if they had their vacancies always filled?
I don't have that number.
Madam Chair, I don't have that number. I can get that number back to you.
I think we're going to become very much more interested in it as we move toward November and February. One of the other questions that we've had, that we've been asking, kind of parked for a while, but I think we need to sort of reactivate it, is the effort, if any, that the veterans' homes are making to get themselves Medicare certified.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's one of the questions that we're going to be discussing at our strategic plan, and one of the things we want to do is have a subcommittee look at that along with the advisory council.
So you'll be looking at it in January?
We will be looking, Madam Chair, we'll be looking at it prior to January.
When will you be looking at it?
Madam Chair, on October 19th, 2008, we're going to be meeting to discuss to finish up our strategic plan. We're going to discuss it at that point. Shortly thereafter, we're going to have a committee meet and start looking at that, and I should have an answer as to, not an answer, but an update as to where we are with it prior to January.
I think that's another area that's going to be very important in terms of the future financing.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Berglund, on that, would you talk a little bit, why is that a discussion rather than a conclusion? That's something that needs to be accomplished. What's the discussion about that? And do you understand what I'm saying?
Senator Sharon, at the time that it was brought up, the Minneapolis Veterans Home wasn't even taking residents because they needed to improve the quality of care that was being given. And so that seemed to be the primary area of focus. But getting the homes Medicare certified is important in terms of a long-term financing strategy because the veterans' homes are available for spouses as well as veterans. And there may be revenue that we could generate through Medicare or some of these days that then would reduce the reliance on state funding.
Precisely, and so that's why it's confusing to me as to why it would even be a question of whether or not we wouldn't be pursuing that right yesterday.
Well, I don't think that the Minneapolis home a year ago would have been in a position to get Medicare certified.
But it has a set of criteria in order to be certified that would help improve the quality of the services. So
yes,
utilizing those criteria as a part of the benchmarks and a part of the process that's been going on for some time now, it seems to me, it's disturbing to me that it's still out there rather than been incorporated in the whole process of determining how we're going to achieve that as a part of upgrading the quality of care.
Well, Senator Sharon, part of the difficulty also is that we've continually been changing personnel. And it's very hard to move into doing something new or different when you're always kind of in a state of flux regarding the leadership. We hope we're coming to an end of that, at least. How often do you update your individual care plan for your residents?
Madam Chair, that's done, well, on an individual basis as needed. As a minimum, it would be quarterly reviewed, but if there's a significant change in resident status, it would be updated at that time.
And what is the potential range of things that could be done to the Minneapolis home by the Department of Justice?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, some of the things that can occur is that once they come in, they'll find that we are compliant with their investigation and they can withdraw the actual investigation. If they find there are areas that are deficient, they can recommend ways to correct those. And at that point, we have a set amount of time to show improvement or correction. They will also make other agencies available to us so that to assist us with that. If at that point we fail to meet the compliance, there is a potential that there could be monetary fines in a lawsuit.
And what would the range of the monetary fines be?
I do not know. Madam Chair, I do not know.
Well, I think we should probably find out. We would hope that wouldn't happen, but the fact that it could possibly happen is another thing to worry about. Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, I would just request that when the findings are issued, I think that it would be appropriate that members of this committee be notified of that accordingly, immediately, so that we are not reading about the findings in the newspaper.
I would agree. In spite of the slide that says that you've kept legislative chairs updated, I found out about the Department of Justice through the newspaper. So if you're keeping us updated, it's not on a very timely fashion, is what I would say. And I think we'd like to be updated in a little bit more timely fashion.
Yes,
I also would like to request that we get a copy of each mock survey that is done and the results of the resurvey, because that is oftentimes very telling in terms of what potentially will be happening with the Department of Health or the Veterans Affairs surveys that would take place. Other questions? I think it also would be important for us to be notified of what you are doing in regard to the committee that will be set up to look at Medicare certification. and we'll be looking for the amount of additional costs that you are incurring because of the use of overtime and contract help. Anything else? Not. Thank you very much, and good luck with your efforts. We hope you continue to improve.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you. Committee members, thank you very much.
Next on the agenda, we have the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. Give us a report about a survey that was done of the Cambridge facility.
So this is out of there. So. This is 08 and 09, so this wouldn't be showing you, right? This is 6 and 7?
This is ongoing.
Oh, sure, that's the future.
Senator Berglund, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present our report. And my name is Roberta Opheim. I'm the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And with me is Arlene Wegner, who was the chief investigator on this particular project. I'm sending up to you a disc that was handed to me by a family member of an individual who was at MEDO because it contains information of what they individually went through, and since they didn't know if they'd have an opportunity to testify, I just simply said I would provide that disc. Two other investigators are here in case you would have questions. There were three individuals involved in this particular report. I want to preface this by saying that the Ombudsman views the use of restraints, whether they be manual, mechanical, or chemical, as one of the most dehumanizing experiences an individual can go through. And I think it would be we would be remiss if we only focused on what is the shocking factor in my mind, which was the use of metal law enforcement handcuffs in the implementation of the restraints, which certainly was contrary to most healthcare settings, but that wasn't the only issue that we found. Having said that, we recognize that there are certain situations where it may be necessary to protect the person from themselves or to protect someone else in the most extreme circumstances where restraints may, in fact, need to be applied, and that in some cases that mechanical restraints are safer for all parties involved than manual restraints. It does not mean, however, that we believe that they should be programmatically used on a routine basis with individuals. I understand that for the general population, that people who see and witness behavior say, boy, I wouldn't know what to do in that scenario. Gee, I have to accept whatever the professionals tell me. And for the average citizen, they don't know what they would do in a similar situation. But the individuals who run the MEDO program are not ordinary citizens who are not ill-trained. They are well-trained, highly paid professional staff who should know and understand state-of-the-art and best practice standards. There's just a couple comments I want to make before I talk at all about the report. The focus of the report is about treatment at MEDO, but I want to make it clear that there are other factors, systemic factors, that led to the situation at MEDO, the reasons clients were placed there, and the reasons that there are difficulty in getting those clients out. And I think that those systemic factors have led to sort of a loss of the original purpose of MEDO and the focus on the unique need of MEDO. I also want to comment on there's some implication that the problem has been fixed, and we certainly are very encouraged by the actions that the department has taken. But we remain concerned that a culture that led to this practice doesn't turn around simply because you write new policies and procedures, that it will take longer than that to turn it around. There is a need in Minnesota for a facility like MITO, as visioned in the legislation and is set out in its original development and some of the plans that were in place. We need a state-of-the-art facility to stabilize individuals who have some of the most challenging behaviors out there. But it should be state-of-the-art, designed to train and lead others so that people aren't disrupted from their community placements. One of the things in the Star Tribune coverage of the report, there was an implication that the ombudsman may be seeing this as part of some overall budget cuts to agencies and the stresses that the budget cuts. I want to make it perfectly clear that this report is about humanity. It is not about money. The facility is paid $906 per day per person who is there. They have highly credentialed individuals who should be well-versed in this, and their staffing ratios are very good. This is not an issue about money. Systemic issues may be different, but there are adequate funds there to treat these people with state-of-the-art dignity and respect and return them to the community, hopefully in better, more stable shape than when they came into the facility. This report is about humanity, dignity, state-of-the-art, clinical, and philosophy of care. And we felt that the facility had lost sight of its mission and had slid into mere behavior containment. Mere behavior containment could be achieved at a lot less cost, but isn't the right or the humane thing to do. This practice became the culture and became ingrained as what I would refer to as group think, where pretty soon everyone in the facility who might challenge each other on a professional level had fallen into the same pattern of thinking. The ombudsman certainly was aware of the Department of Justice, Office of Civil Rights, the very agency that has just come into the matter in front of you before this, and that there was a potential that if this practice continued, that there could be a CRIPA report or Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons. Our goal was an attempt to get the attention of the department in an effort to prevent the need for the Department of Justice to come in with the MITO program. We certainly don't know whether the Department of Justice has any interest in this particular program, but our goal, of course, is to turn practices around before they reach the level of legal or federal intervention. The report outlines the evidence gathered by the ombudsman in developing the report. We worked with the licensing departments, as our legislation instructs us to do, to minimize the use of resources, protect evidence. We worked with them in an effort not to duplicate their efforts. What we wanted to know from licensing was if the information gathered by licensing supported or refuted the basic allegations that had been brought to our attention. It was clear that their work supported that the allegations in general had merit. The ombudsman then focused on other aspects, including the highest attainable standards, not just the minimum standards required in the licensing. In addition, if the ombudsman believed that the program was committed to change, was working to eliminate the need for restraints, we would not have felt the need to be in there for a year long, nor would we have felt the need to write a report. Things that led us to believe that the program itself would not make these changes without some degree of pressure included the fact that when the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services through the Department of Health issued citations, some 69 pages, including the plan of correction, and another 29 pages On the non-CMS side, the program said it would eliminate the use of certain restraints in the two units that were certified by CMS. When we asked them, well, how about the rest of the individuals there, as behavior issues were the common factor between the two, instead of answering about the uniqueness of the clients, the response we got was the rules are tougher on the two units that receive federal certification than they are on the other units. They clearly indicated to us that they fully intended to reserve the right to use the same practices on the non-ICFMS units, the other six units, because they weren't governed by the same rules. No mention was made of the client populations being different or the uniquenesses or the individual nature of any given client. Comments were made by staff that said if they could not use restraints, then they could not treat these individuals as if this was an either-or form of treatment rather than a graduated program systematically designed to turn things around where restraints were viewed as a treatment of last resort, not an ordinary course of treatment. There had not been much effort in the past to assess and measure success or lack of success of the restraint. As you might imagine, everyone repeats the often used phrase that we see on some of these flyers about idiocy. It's doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result. Well, when you have to restrain someone 299 times in 1 year, it says to me, whatever your program or plan of care is, that it's not working. And then what is being done to assess it? And we didn't see enough assessment to say, okay, that program's not working. What else could we do? Some of the decisions were based on assumptions rather than on good data collection, and we became concerned. So in conclusion, I want to state I'm very encouraged by actions that state-operated services and the Disability Services Division of DHS are taking. Their consultants' report gives a good roadmap and some detail and recommendations on the very findings and recommendations that the ombudsman had, but give them, to some degree, a roadmap to follow. The consultants clearly stated that the use of restraints is not current best practice standards, and I appreciate the support. That's certainly the belief of the ombudsman. However, the ombudsman remains concerned and will continue to monitor continued use of restraints and efforts at reduction. Our feedback says that they are reducing the use of restraints, but we want to ensure that habitual practices don't creep back into practice when the pressure is off. We remain concerned that the clinical philosophy doesn't clearly understand why the use of restraints are such a problematic practice, both treatment-wise and from a civil and human rights side. And we also remain concerned because restraints continued to be used, although there seems to be been a general reduction, according to the Minnesota Disability Law Center's most recent visit there. Mental handcuffs continued to be used well into September after it was clearly stated that they would stop in August. And plans that are there are still not clinically specific to the individual, where when challenged on certain practices in the person's plan, the Disability Law Center was clearly told, well, we're not applying those standards to the individual, which means to me the plan is not individualized to that particular individual. Those are some of the things that remain concerned, but I am very encouraged that DHS is taking this seriously and is moving forward. But with that, I would stand for any questions.
Ms. Opheim, based on your assessment, how long a period of time was the use of regular restraints going on at the Cambridge facility?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's somewhat difficult to assess, but what we got was general feedback that had been going on for at least 2 years, that it seemed to be a gradual change into this practice. And so we can't say specifically, but it certainly wasn't the philosophy of care in the beginning of the development of the program, but that it had been for at least the previous 2+ years to our embarking upon the report.
And when you looked at the facility, were the use of these restraints being noted in the charts?
They were being noted in the charts. Part of what kind of overwhelmed us as we looked at the restraints, as we indicate in the report, we first had a complaint where we guided the parents in some actions they could take themselves. They reported the handcuffs and some of the restraints were being used. We thought the problem was solved. Months later, we got a second report that basically said the same practices were being used on another individual. We initially went in and drew 5 records. From those 5 records, we had a concern and went to licensing, both health and human service licensing. And after some of the concerns we saw, we decided to go in and do a comprehensive review. The day we went in and sent multiple people in and said we want to look at every record, the initial review said that there were 65% of the people had been restrained, but many of them multiple times. But what was not evident was the number of times they were really being used. And that was because the working files that were in place on the day of the review didn't contain some of the material that had been archived in other files simply by virtue of the volume of the record. And when we asked to see all of the records on the individuals, that's when we discovered just stacks of incident reports. What was notable in the incident reports were part of the permissive use of Rule 40, which is not meant to be permissive that restraints are okay, but permissive in the sense that says if you know that someone might suddenly engage in a behavior, you ought to have a thoughtful plan, one, on how you're going to redirect the behavior before it gets dangerous, or two, how to safely implement a restraint that works for the least amount of time. When they were asked to make notation about what alternative methods were used to redirect the client, many times it said NA, not applicable. So the behavior triggered the restraint. And again, they were behaviors that, while we certainly recognize they could be precursors to someone getting upset and being upset leading to dangerous behaviors, they weren't in and of themselves dangerous behaviors, which is usually a requirement for the use of a Rule 40. Also, that was the indicator as to when a redirective approach should have been taken. So to read non-applicable gave rise to concern.
Other questions?
May I just follow
Senator
up on that?
Sharon.
When you reviewed the records, are the records written in a way that there's a documentation of an escalating behavior? Is there a record that indicates simply that a restraint was applied, or is there in the documentation anything that shows that there's been an observation about changing pattern of behavior?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm going to defer that question to Arlene Wegner, who led the team of people who actually reviewed the records.
Senator Sharon, what we read in the records was that an individual had some kind of behavior that was seen as a target behavior in their program that initiated the restraint. There wasn't oftentimes, in several situations there was, but oftentimes there was no documentation that indicated a lead up to that behavior or what was going on with that individual before the restraint. Oftentimes it was 1 or 2 sentences. That was it.
Senator Sharon.
The you can't really draw a conclusion that that wasn't there from that, though. There, it simply wasn't documented. And but the way you said that, I have to check out. You said that there was a target behavior that resulted in a restraint as a response. It sounds to me, and I'm not sure that you meant this, that it was the treatment for the target behavior rather than, if this target behavior that needed to be changed was exhibited, their change methodology was to institute restraint as a behavioral intervention rather than the purpose for which restraint is identified, which is protection, after a series of other interventions have failed. Am I hearing you that you're saying it appears as though it was used as an intervention rather than for its appropriate purpose?
Yes, that what you're saying is correct.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me clarify that that certainly is a question that would be raised. You know, what's the purpose of a Rule 40 procedure? It's to define what to do to try to prevent the escalating behavior and then how to intervene if you can't prevent the escalating behavior. The pattern and the use of restraints over time was clear to us that this was the behavioral treatment, not the prevention of the dangerous target behavior.
Other questions? No, thank you.
Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner Coleman and Mr. Tesmer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lauren Coleman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services for Continuing Care and the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Chemical, Mental Health, and State-Operated Services. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, its unique mission in Minnesota, and the improvements that have been made over the past year. As you're aware, MEDO treats people who are civilly committed by the courts who pose a risk to the public and can demonstrate violent behaviors. It means that the use of some type of restraint within this program may be necessary to safeguard patients and staff. However, let me be clear, metal handcuffs are no longer being used, and we are also considering the expert panel's recommendations regarding alternatives to mechanical restraints that are used. Working with the Ombudsman's Office that you've just heard about, beginning approximately in the fall of 2007, the department completed a comprehensive review of the MEDO program, including the use of restraints. The plan of correction resulting from those discussions has included prohibiting the use of restraints in response to any behavior that does not pose a risk of immediate serious injury. Revised individual program plans for all clients to ensure that each includes a specific system of positive behavioral supports to help the individual gain skills to avoid violent behavior. Authorization and supervision of the use of restraints by MEDO's clinical and administrative leadership. And a change in the treatment strategies that when problem behaviors persist. This past summer, we called in a four-person team of national experts in serving people with disabilities who pose high-risk behaviors. We were seeking cutting-edge thinking on best treatment for this population. You've been presented with the written report and the recommendations from that expert panel that we received just recently. We've already begun to implement some of those recommendations and are in discussions to implement others. We also intend to invite the panel back in 12 to 18 months to assess our progress on the program. As a result of what we have learned from this panel and the state agencies that have reviewed MEDO, We've employed strategies that have resulted in a reduction in the percentage of clients on whom restraints were used from about 35% in July of 2007 to less than 3% currently in the month of October. The average number of minutes a client would be placed in restraints has dropped from an average of 160 minutes in July 2007 to most recently less than 10 minutes. Again, we have directed that restraints must always be employed only in response to behavior posing a risk of immediate serious injury and always in concert with documented treatment and teaching to try to improve patients' behavior over time. Other recommendations of the expert panel had to deal with issues relating to admission to the MEDO program and the length of stay in the program. Since the beginning of the year, the Disability Services Division within DHS and state-operated services have worked with counties, providers, and families on achieving placement of individuals in community-based programs rather than admission to MEDO. We've also have worked more toward more timely placement of individuals in the community once behaviors have stabilized at MEDO. Indicators of progress on this front are the average daily population in the program has been reduced from a maximum capacity at 48 individuals at the start of 2007 to a current population of 35. Before January of this year, 20 of the patients at MEDO had been there longer than 18 months. Since then, 13 of those individuals, with stays ranging from 18 months to more than 10 years, have been discharged to the community. A new focus on discharging to the community has been the practice in 2008. The leadership and staff at MEDO are committed to improving and meeting the complex needs of this challenging group of patients. And 2008 can be characterized as a renewed focus on not only the use of mechanical restraints, but in using the program as it's originally intended and stabilizing people and returning them to the community as the data suggests. We're happy to respond to any questions you may have about the progress that we've made at MEDO.
What kind of restraints are currently being used?
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Tessner. I'm the Chief Executive of State Operated Services. The current restraints that are being used are those that you'd find in other healthcare situations. So there's soft ties, which go around the wrists or the waist or the ankle to restrain person's mobility, or vinyl cuffs that you'd find in an emergency room or a psychiatric hospital.
And I guess the other question I have is, do you guys from the central office go up there and visit ever? I mean, really, how could this have been going on for so long and nobody knew about it except the ombudsman?
Well, Madam Chair, the MEDO program is certainly a unique program. I would suggest that the system of oversight, including the ombudsman's office, is a collective oversight and demonstrates that where problems are identified, we try to address those. As to the frequency of visits from the central office, I can't address that.
Well, I would be interested to know in the last year how often someone from the central office has been up there to observe, you know, how they're doing. It would seem to me that would be something you would do periodically.
Madam Chair, request noted.
Are there other questions, Senator Sharon?
I had a similar question. Do you have recommendations to us for how we can improve the oversight process? Because this is, you know, we're talking today about things that are problematic because we haven't had adequate oversight, not just this, but with the veterans program. So what is it that we need to do differently in supporting oversight and quality assurance in these programs before it has to be reported as by the federal government or by the ombudsman or by a family member? What's the recommendation here for not having this process continue?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Schurin, certainly a strategy that the department has attempted to pursue over the last number of years is more public disclosure. Certainly, we've tried to provide more information about healthcare facilities via report cards or clinical indicators, website-like strategies. That has certainly brought a greater amount of scrutiny to all who wish to see what the outcomes of these programs are. In addition to that, I think this this hearing, as well as the demonstrated investigation and trying to find solutions to these challenging problems, is evidence that there is a fair amount of attention being placed to these programs. Clinical practices change over time, and I think this is one of those that certainly can't be defended, but when identified, was responded to.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Schurin.
This is really not a clinical practice that can be justified, and it's not new. There's a long period of time in which we've understood that we ought not be restraining people as a behavioral intervention. And it's an outrage. And when I hear in the earlier report, or I read through this report, I think, which is from the Department of Human Services, about the highly qualified staff that is in this system, and then, so it isn't an issue of preparation or qualifications, I find this just absolutely a challenge to grasp how a culture could change like this. And it just makes me very curious to know, how could have this occurred? Is there no oversight? One time after another, we sit in this committee asking questions about how did something deteriorate to such a degree. And I never hear what we're doing differently to make sure that we're identifying cultural problems earlier and intervening. And in terms of any mental health professional accepting that you do not identify early anger management problems and intervene earlier in some other way other than physical, and now I'm concerned medical restraint. We're talking about, you know, physical restraint here. What's to assure us we aren't going to shift over into some medicating patients in order to contain, rather than really addressing the issue of a person's ability to manage anger? And I do think transparency has to be a part of this. And the mentally ill can often be dismissed if we do surveys, if we increase the requirements for public feedback as to the experience, including the patient, and not dismissing the feedback that we're getting from patients because they're not reliable due to their mental illness. Then, and this whole phenomena around the abuse of restraint, the abuse of people with restraint, in this day and age, with what we know about mental health and mental illness, I think is frightening, and I hope this committee pays very close attention to this, and that we do not step away as a legislative committee from our oversight responsibility. And I think one of the questions we ought to ask is, what are we going to do as a legislative group to make certain that we up our oversight process on these legislative things? It's just too much of a pattern of the failure of the system to oversee its own services.
Well, Senator Schurin, we have made a commitment when we know there are issues to continue to have oversight hearings until we believe that the issues have been resolved over a fairly reasonable period of time. So I expect we'll be having other hearings on this, and we'll get to see you gentlemen again. I guess one of the questions I have is, how do you know what kind of restraints they're using today up in Cambridge?
Madam Chair, I was there on Friday and looked at the menu of restraints that they're currently using. That's how I know.
And when would you be going up there again to see how they're doing?
Madam Chair, most likely in the coming month.
And is there a mechanism for you to review or to get a report on the kind of patients that are being admitted to Cambridge as opposed to the kind of patient that might be receiving services in their own group home from the state in terms of behavior issues?
Madam Chair, there's a utilization management report that looks at people being admitted to all the state-operated services facilities and the appropriateness of those, because sometimes people will get referred to a program that they don't fit in. MITO is utilizing that process, although that is one of the things that we have changed. Assistant Commissioner Coleman alluded to, getting back to the core mission. Persons with mental retardation but who do not present a risk to the public, starting in November, will no longer be served in the MITO program. Those folks will be diverted to a community-based alternative, short-term in its nature, because these are people who have to leave where they're at and they need some place to go, but it's not intended to be a long-term stay. So that's one of the changes that we're making to structure the program, and it's also an outgrowth of monitoring your question of who's going in and do they actually need that level of care.
So who will be served in the MITO program after?
It will revert to its original mission, which is persons with mental retardation who represent a risk to the public.
And is that a determination that's made by the court? Or who makes that determination?
It certainly is under consideration at the court level. We have an admission review committee that looks at every referral into the MITO program from the court system to ensure that they're appropriately placed.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Sharon.
I'm sorry. I find this very distressing. And I do think that we've had oversight hearings every to see the progress in the movement, but I'm talking about something more consistent that holds everybody more accountable and aware that there is another eye sort of looking in on this. And I really appreciate your coming here and talking about this today. What concerns me is that I don't hear alarm from you, and that you aren't coming here and saying something to us about something like oversight has been abandoned in the Department of Human Services. And maybe you can't say this because we don't have enough money, or we're stretched so thinly, or we don't have the capacity to really go and look. We underfund everything. We lower our staffing ratios. We don't have access to the professional people that we need in certain places. And plus, we don't have the people to do the quality assurance. So I just don't hear that coming back from the department to say, we're alarmed too. And we really think we need to address issues within the Department of Human Services. It always seems that when we get these reports back in the committee here, it's sort of, we're sort of massaging this along and trying to resolve with things. Well, these are real people, real veterans, real mentally ill or mentally retarded persons with mental disabilities that are vulnerable. And if we don't have an oversight process going on, these are persons that are going to have, and we're straining our staffs in ways that they don't know how to address difficult situations, and we don't have our own departments advocating for change. It's just very troubling to me. Yeah. I don't trust that we'll see immediate change on the specific question that we're looking at specifically right now, but then something else will emerge, and we'll be back here talking about this again in some other little spot, some other balloon bubble will shove out over here, and we'll sort of push that puppy in, and then room, it'll come out over here. And in the meantime, we haven't really done what we need to do to have an energetic, aggressive look at, transparent look outside of the department, having the department have a place where they need to consistently be held not you know, like your a report card, so to speak, but that drives everybody to do excellence in what we're doing when we're serving the public.
Madam Chair, Senator Sherrin, if you allow me, I certainly would not want to be interpreted as this was considered business as usual and that there wasn't great distress about the findings of the report and the manner in which this topic was identified and addressed. I would concur that we should have found better practices on our own to address this challenging population. We are committed to the use of the outside consultants, the expert panel, to continue to work with them. We can provide updates, progress reports on what actions have been taken to sustain the improvement that has already begun. But additionally, and I don't want to put pressure on a gentleman before he even joins us, but we do have an assistant commissioner joining us the beginning of November, Dr. Reed Sulik, who is a board-certified pediatrician, child health and mental health and adult mental health physician from CentraCare, who will be responsible for this area. And I would certainly anticipate that his clinical background in working with populations of all needs will be a valuable tool at looking at clinical standards, practice patterns, strategies to identify and improve before it gets to this level. So we look forward to that level of expertise on our management team.
I guess I just have to reiterate, not only is it very disturbing to find out that this was actually going on, but for the length of time that it was going on. You know, I'm glad we have the Office for Ombudsman. I was part of helping to create the office. But it seems to me that there also is a responsibility within the department to monitor the operations that you are responsible for in some sort of an ongoing manner so that you would have known before the Ombudsman's office even was getting complaints that this practice was taking place. And I just don't understand why it was going on for so long. It would seem to me you would have known about it and would have sort of more or less nipped it in the bud. You know, do you know that this isn't going on in any other facility that the department is charged with operating?
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I couldn't attest that there aren't practices going on elsewhere, but our quality assurance program certainly does require more diligence when we have episodes like this, and we can do better.
And so are you looking at your other operations as well then to make sure people are being treated in a dignified manner?
Madam Chair, we will reemphasize with the Executive Committee of State Operated Services that that is a priority, and I will be happy to provide you an update on that also.
Other questions, Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was my question exactly, is what kind of assurance do we have that this isn't happening elsewhere? And how disappointing, frankly, that you need to feel like you need to come here today in order that it become apparent to you that you need to go back and check with all of your organizations. I think we need to be very clear. There are no shortage of challenges before this committee today, Madam Chair, but this is a direct reflection on DHS. That's the bottom line. And I have to wonder who is leading? Who is leading? Because what we have seen is unacceptable. And I think it's troubling that I have to sit here today with my colleagues and even suggest that the department need to take a look at its other services and organizations.
Well, you know, we have made it clear to organizations that we contract with that we have standards we measure them by in regard to quality when it comes to caring for our long-term care residents. And I believe we should be applying similar standards to operations that we run ourselves. I guess at this point we can only kind of watch and wait and assure you we will have you back to talk to us again about this subject. And I would just have to say again to you, I do not expect to learn about these things by reading about it in the newspaper. I may read about it in the newspaper, but I expect to have been informed that the newspaper would be carrying some bad news ahead of time. And that did not happen in this case. All right. The next item on the agenda is a report from Tim Wilkin, Assistant Commissioner in the Department of Human Services, in regard to systems that have been put into place by the Department of Human Services to prevent employee fraud and abuse, financial employee fraud and abuse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. I'm Tim Wilkin, Assistant Commissioner of Policy Development at DHS. Your invitation for DHS testimony was prompted by recent news reports regarding a DHS employee who was allegedly involved in embezzlement of funds. Since the matter is under investigation, I cannot discuss anything specific at all about the case or any other things that may or may not be under investigation. What I can tell you is our department takes any matters like this very seriously and will work closely with investigators on any matter that needs to be reviewed and accumulate any necessary evidence or controls that need to be in place. Madam Chair, I'm prepared to give a general overview of internal controls, but it can't be specific or specifically related to any incident that may or may not have happened. Internal fraud prevention is conducted in many areas at DHS. Processes and procedures are in place which govern entities and individuals working with the department and in local human services agencies. DHS provides training and response to ethical concerns of employees. The department maintains legal and ethical policies and procedures. Every new employee goes through an ethics training program. And the department also conducted a series recently of divisional meetings on ethical requirements for employees. The department's internal fraud controls also include forensic auditing. Specifically, when a complaint or concern is raised, the agency has the capacity to forensically audit employee electronic activity. The department considers data practices and data security to be a key priority. Every employee is required to take training on an annual basis. The department has specific employee policy with regard to reporting of fraud and abuse that mirrors the state statutes that require that be reported to the state auditor. The department began conducting employee background checks on new employees in August of 2007. The department financial operations are administered according to statewide policies established by the state's Minnesota Management and Budget Department, which is formerly the Department of Finance. These policies address internal controls by requiring system access controls, separation of duties, compensating controls, and reconciliation and reporting. DHS conducts these activities within the discipline of generally accepted accounting principles and the oversight recommendations of the Office of Legislative Auditor, which occur on a regular basis. Also, the Federal General Accounting Office and Office of Inspector General on an occasional basis. The primary audit agency is the Office of Legislative Auditor, and they conduct two types of financial audits. First, they conduct the department's annual financial audit and federal compliance audit, known as a single audit. This audit has two parts. First, it is to certify the state's financial statements, and second, to review our compliance with federal program requirements. Second, the OLA conducts limited fiscal and IT audits. These audits are narrow in scope and usually cover selected areas such as Maxis data integrity, state-operated services, account receivable and payroll, eligibility data validation controls, Board on Aging, MMIS security controls. We take the findings and recommendations very seriously. For both types of audits, we develop and implement corrective action plans to fix the problems. We have a tracking system for these type of corrections, and the department's management is kept informed of the department's progress on addressing these. The following year, the OLA will review our corrective action and determine if adequate corrective action has been and progress has been made for that year. If we have not completed our work, they will review our progress. The recommendations stay open until the OLA is satisfied with our corrective action. The last six financial audits contain 27 findings with 41 recommendations. We have implemented corrective actions for 34 of the recommendations. Six of the remaining are scheduled to be completed next year. The last seven fiscal and IT audits contain 35 findings and 46 recommendations. We have implemented and completed corrective actions for 42 of the recommendations. The remaining will be corrected next year. As part of the federal single audit procedures, audit findings and recommendations are reported to the Federal Audit Clearinghouse and distributed to the appropriate federal program area. In addition to the OLA audits, DHS undergoes federal fiscal reviews. DHS is a voluntary participant and a lead state in the federal government's new Medicaid Integrity Program. I'll give you an example of how we address a problem when it comes up. You'll recall that last year DHS dealt with a fiscal fraud when an employee inadvertently miskeyed two digits that coincidentally corresponded with a valid vendor in the statewide payment system. The vendor, Sabrina Walker, had legitimately received state pay of $84 as a witness fee from the court system. Upon mistakenly receiving a check for $2.6 million intended to go to Hennepin County Medical Center, she cashed and spent a portion of that amount. DHS worked with law enforcement and banks to freeze the funds and recover the resulting assets and to charge Ms. Walker. The legal portion of that case was just wrapped up in the last few weeks. Ms. Walker was convicted and sentenced to 3 years probation and 9 months in a workhouse and ordered to pay restitution. DHS took many administrative steps immediately following the incident to review internal controls and the Department of Finance policies to mitigate such an event. Over the months following the discovery of the case, DHS's financial operations, the OLA, our internal audit staff, and the Department of Finance worked to make permanent improvements and mitigations. These changes are documented in the memo I distributed from DHS to the Department of Finance, which should be in your packets. You will note the memo outlines several specific detailed changes within DHS procedures and practices. In this particular situation, for example, DHS committed to migration of all payment entries into a single unit. That change was completed in February of this year. The memo also notes changes to the statewide procedures managed by the Department of Finance, now Minnesota Management and Budget. In this particular case, MMB amended state payment policy to require secondary approval of any manual payments above $100,000. The memo also notes important changes in capacities that must be present in the next generation of the state's electronic payment system, currently known as MAPS. In this particular situation, for example, DHS noted that the future state payment computer system must distinguish between individual and business vendors to create a better automated way for the system to flag a situation such as the one that occurred in the Walker case. This is an example of the approach DHS takes when it encounters vulnerabilities or breaches in its financial systems. It is an ongoing, detailed, and methodical approach to protecting states' resources to ensure that they are used efficiently and appropriately by all parties involved in the system. Minnesota is respected by other states for its proactive approach in managing its programs, inviting and responding to constructive audit findings and treating fraud and abuse efforts as part of all stages of the program, not just a pay and chase method after incidents are detected. We continue to apply a serious and analytical approach to program integrity and fraud and abuse vulnerabilities as incidents and recommendations. Madam Chair, I'm happy to take questions.
Are there questions? I guess one of the questions that I have is, when someone applies for a medical assistance vendor number, don't they have to provide some other documentation to the department that, you know, A, they have licensed personnel that would provide the services that are intended to be provided by the entity, and B, that they have filed officially with the IRS to, you know, be in compliance with tax policies?
Madam Chair, I'm sure there's specific controls in place that would address those situations, and I'm sure we're assessing them right now. I'm not in a position to outline those here, but we're happy to take that question back and make sure that we get you a thorough response when we're able to.
Well, and I guess the question would include, you know, how far back, if this policy exists now, how far back has the policy existed?
Yes, we'll get you that information.
Other questions, Senator Sharon?
Is there when someone sets up a vendor relationship with the Department of Human Services, are there checks about not only the legitimacy of the vendor? Is there, does one person set up the vendors, and then is it possible for that person to move and be able then to establish a faulty vendor and then move and pay that vendor out?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm not sure exactly what the procedures are and every specific control in that area. We will get you information to address that, though.
But that would be my concern, that there aren't enough firewalls to oversee, so that it just wouldn't trickle up to somebody's consciousness very much if there's not containment between systems that allow for somebody to create a vendor and then also be a payer of a vendor.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm very familiar with the systems that you speak. I was originally trained as an auditor, and after that I insured banks and saw many type of situations where employees or outside fraud was perpetrated. There do need to be mitigating controls in place, and we'll definitely be reviewing any areas that are found to be weak.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, a question for you. I was just interested to know how you became aware of this latest situation.
I read about it in the paper. However, I would not have expected the department to notify me of this because it was an ongoing investigation and they were not making information available to anyone, including the press. I'm still not exactly sure how the press did learn about this situation.
Madam Chair, that is an issue that's outstanding because you're right. We weren't at liberty to inform you, and my intent is to inform you as soon as possible on any of these type of things because I don't want to get the call from your office saying I just read something in the paper.
I would like you to inform me when this latest the individual that is suspected of being involved in this latest incident is apprehended. Other questions? I guess a question I have is I was under the impression that there were things in place, but you're giving me the impression now that there are other things being put in place as we speak or will be put in place next year.
Madam Chair, I can't, as you know, I can't speak to any certain situation on what is in place and what's not in place in a particular situation until a later date.
Right, but you just told us that there were things that the auditor had asked you to do that would be put in place next year.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's for previous audits that have been.
And then you also did say that the department was in the process of reviewing the safeguards they have in place and possibly would be taking additional steps.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to find the right way to express it without going too far. Anytime there's a breakdown in controls, no matter what the situation is, whether it be outside fraud with a vendor or an enrollee or an inside fraud situation, there's going to be a review of the procedures and the controls that are in place to determine if they're adequate or how they broke down. And that would lead to changes in procedures and controls.
Well, if you do change any of your procedures or controls, we would appreciate if you would let us know.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, the meeting will be adjourned.